We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 35. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'll be your host today. And today we are talking about Indigenous archaeology as practice. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch or Ute Peoples Treaty Lands, the Dineta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland.
On today's episode, we have Dr. Keisha Supernant. Some of you may remember Dr. Supernant from episode 30, which we recorded at the SAAs. It was on cultural landscapes. And if you haven't yet, you should check it out. But if you haven't listened yet, Dr. Keisha Supernant is Métis and an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Alberta. She's the director of the Institute of Prairie Archaeology and a leading expert on Indigenous archaeology and geospatial analysis. An award-winning teacher, researcher, and writer, her research explores Indigenous histories, cultural identities, landscapes, remote sensing, spatial analysis, Métis archaeology, and heart-centered archaeological practice. Her research with Indigenous communities in Western Canada explores how archaeologists and communities can build collaborative research relationships. She has published in local and international journals on GIS in archaeology, collaborative archaeological practice, Métis archaeology, and Indigenous archaeology in the Post-Truth and Reconciliation Commission era. She has two edited volumes coming out in 2020. So welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, okay, to get us going, would you mind, since we didn't really get to get into this in the cultural landscapes episode, giving our listeners a little bit of a background on how you got interested in this field?
Absolutely. But just as I get started speaking as well, I will also acknowledge that the territory that I am recording from is a territory of the Treaty 6 Nations. That includes the Cree, Blackfoot, Nakota Sioux, Dene, and also the Métis homeland here in what's known as the Miskatawa-Skyugan or Edmonton, Alberta. And I got first interested in doing archaeology a very long time ago when I was a teenager. My father, who's the Métis side of my family, he was very interested in lost cities and what I now recognize to be sort of pseudo-archaeology interests, so the sort of lost civilizations of the past. And he was reading a series of books, and he had given them to me, and I got hooked on this idea of traveling around the world to all of these really interesting places and exploring histories and exploring things unknown. So I would have been about 13 or 14 when this started to really pick up as an interest for me. And I will remember going to see my high school guidance counselor and telling her I wanted to be an archaeologist. And I was in a small town, actually, and a small school. And I don't think the guidance counselor had ever heard that before. But luckily for me, she was able to find a short document called Archaeology in You. And basically that document said if you wanted to be a professional archaeologist, you needed to go and get a graduate degree, and ideally a PhD is what it said. And so I would be about 15 by that point, and that day I decided to get a PhD in archaeology.
Wow. It's a big commitment for a 15-year-old.
Well, I don't think anybody believed at that time, other than me, that I would actually do that. And to be fair, mm-hmm. I had no idea really what I was getting into. Like, I didn't really understand the field. And I sometimes find it interesting that my journey took me there, right? I did get a PhD in archaeology, but it took me, it's a very different field than what I had originally thought that it was. And certainly I didn't envision doing archaeology with my own Indigenous history at the time. It was very much a go other places, go into the, you know, into what I was really interested in was like the heartland of early civilizations of the Middle East, right? So that was my first draw. Mm-hmm. And I would not have anticipated at that time the importance of me doing work with my own family, my own relatives, and my own histories.
Why do you think, I'm curious, because I feel like I've heard this a good number of times. Why do you think there was that disconnect that it didn't even occur that this was something that you could do at home?
I think a lot of it has to do with how we are educated and how we encounter archaeology through popular culture and through the educational system. And that, of course, as now someone who teaches archaeology, is very important to me. We don't teach people in the North American context as much about the history that's under their feet. Some areas are definitely better for this than others, but I think about my context here in Canada. And when I was growing up, I didn't learn about the nations whose lands I was on. I learned about Greece and Rome and the kind of origins of Western civilization. So when we teach, young students about these sorts of things, we don't ground it in the places that they're in. I think that's starting to change now compared to, 25 years ago when I was going through school. But I don't think anyone ever told me about the fact that there was archaeology under my own feet. I grew up on the West Coast near Vancouver. So much archaeology there, but it was never something I encountered on a day-to-day basis in my educational system, in the media that I was consuming.
So I guess what initially came to my mind when you're saying all of this is, why is there the priority on all of these places of Western civilization? And I think that the answer is pretty obvious, but I'd love to hear you spell it out and hear your thoughts on why certain places get prioritized over others.
So when we think about what we learn about the origins of Western civilization, we learn about the cradle of civilization more broadly, and we learn about the history of colonization. So I think, again, in the Canadian context, the stories that we hear are about the colonial history. We don't hear about the Indigenous histories of those lands. And that's a direct reflection of the ongoing colonial nature of these nation states and the histories that they want to teach the members of those nation states about, right? So these things are all very much interconnected. And there's also, when we do hear about Indigenous histories, there's a strong sense of disconnect between Indigenous pasts and Indigenous presence. So I think this is another layer to this colonial narrative, is that if you do hear about Indigenous peoples, especially talking about North American contexts, there's a sense of they were here, right? We were here. We are here. Mm-hmm. And this is a really important tool in the colonial erasure of Indigenous peoples, right? If you only make us this traditional authentic version that sits in the imagination of contemporary peoples, then you erase us from the present and erase the ongoing impacts that colonization has on our communities, right? So these things are all intertwined in the ways in which we teach people about Indigenous histories and Indigenous present.
Which, and I mean, again, I've said this, I feel like, a million times on the show, but is absurd, because obviously we are not, the rest of us also are not like we were 100 years ago. I'm not going around in a wagon and dressing like that. And, I'm not, my Jewish heritage, they were doing that in a very different way than I am today. And it doesn't make me any less Jewish. It doesn't make me any less American. So that metric is just beyond absurd to me. But I've said that before, so you all just get to listen to me say it again.
Yeah, and I think it's also the ways in which we teach about progress and civilizations. And this is all tied in, again, to that colonial project of setting a certain version of life as somehow superior, and that plays into some of these dynamics as well. And now in Canada, there's different histories. They're related to ones in America, but they are different in their own ways. And the one thing I will say is, talking with Indigenous colleagues from the U.S. is that in Canada, there is less Indigenous erasure. It's still present, but we are more part of the national conversation than in the United States. So there's a more of an attention to broadly Indigenous communities, Indigenous issues in Canada than there is in the United States right now. But at the same time, there's still been those very deep and ongoing legacies of colonization.
Right, right. And there are some examples which we don't necessarily need to get into. You know, we don't want to do any trauma porn on the show, but some recent events that really show that, you know, just like the Black Lives Matter and Native Lives Matter movements in the U.S., that's also very much still an issue in
Canada as
well.
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot. And there's been a lot in the national conversation over the last 10 years in Canada in particular, because of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that we had, which was designed to talk about the legacies, particularly of our residential school system, and was designed to kind of witness the truth of that and then think about ways to move toward a different future. And under the term sort of reconciliation, how do we come together? And the fallout from a lot of that is still being very much engaged with throughout Canada.
Can you explain what the fallout is? Well, first of all, can you explain a little bit more about what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is for our non-Canadian listeners? And second, what has that fallout been?
Yes, I can. So the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada was modeled somewhat after the post-apartheid Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. And the purpose of these commissions really is to invite survivors to tell their stories about the experiences that they had. So in this particular case, the focus of our Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which I will hereafter refer to as the TRC, was to create a space for survivors of the residential school program in Canada. So the residential school program in Canada was a government-sanctioned program where Indigenous children were taken from their communities and put into boarding schools run by Christian organizations. So different churches ran the different schools. The purpose of this was to assimilate Indigenous children and make them no longer Indigenous. So to strip them of their language, their connection to culture, their kinship relations, their ways of knowing and being, and to make them good Christian people. This went on for over 100 years, and generations of Indigenous children went to these schools and created a huge amount of disruption in Indigenous communities. So the purpose of the TRC was to grapple with this legacy, to collect documentation related to it, to allow space for survivors to tell their stories, and to acknowledge the harm that was done through this residential schools program. The last school closed in 1996 in Canada.
Okay. Okay. My question is, I mean, is this like is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, is this on the nightly news, for example? Is this something that any Canadian would know about, or is this something that we hear a lot about in, from, you know, our colleagues in Canada that are working in this field, but it's something that the general public hasn't really heard about?
I would say that most Canadians will have heard of the TRC, and many Canadians will have engaged in the different events that were held. So there was events held all across Canada, these large events where people were invited to come and bear witness to some of the stories, invited to tell their stories. And in some cases, for example, I know at the University of British Columbia, they actually canceled classes the day that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was in Vancouver to allow their students to go and participate. So it was a big national initiative, and it led to some really interesting discussions once it was complete. So it completed a number of years ago, and part of what it did was generate a large report. So there's I think it's about a 600-page report. There's an executive summary, but there were also 94 calls to action. So the three commissioners of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission worked with what they had heard and basically issued to all Canadians 94 calls to action. And these calls to action related to a number of different things. Some of them were very specific to the residential school experience, but some of them were about access to education, the role of commemoration and heritage, the role of the law. So it was very much this wide-ranging set of calls to action. And they sometimes get referred to as recommendations, but they are not recommendations. They are calls to action. So they're asking Canadians to act to make these changes. And there's some great resources.
That's a really interesting distinction. So you're saying that it went out to all Canadians, not, you know, these are quote unquote recommendations.
That's exactly right.
To the Canadian government.
These were calls to Canadians to act. And some Canadians are better positioned to act on these. And they are accessible freely online. And there's also a great series on YouTube where a number of folks read out the different calls to action. So you can actually access that and you can listen to them. Because many of them, while specific to some elements of Canada, have broad application in many colonial contexts because the histories are so interrelated, especially in British colonies and British-related colonies. They also have really interesting implications for those of us who work in heritage. And so some of them speak to museums, but some of them also speak to helping mark and commemorate these residential school locations. And in particular, a number of children went missing. And so they basically fall out of the records of these schools. They kind of disappear from the records. And in many cases, there's not clarity about what happened to them. But it is likely that a number of them died for a variety of reasons. And one of the calls to action is about helping to try to find these missing children. And that's something that archaeologists and biological anthropologists have skill sets to be able to assist with. So some of my work in the last year, especially, I've been asked to participate and help with helping to find some of the locations where these missing children might have been illicitly buried around residential school sites.
Yeah. And I think you talked a little bit about that as well on the previous podcast.
Yeah. Episode. That work is difficult work, but it's a direct response to this call to action that came out of this important commission.
Okay, so we're right about at a stopping point, but I am curious before we do that real quick, if you just want to really briefly touch on the fallout that you mentioned.
Sure. So since the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's calls to action, which were released now about 4 years ago, there's been a lot of conversation in Canada about what reconciliation looks like. A number of Indigenous people, Indigenous scholars, react quite strongly against the idea of reconciliation because it assumes that there was at some point conciliation, when in fact the relationship between, you know, the colonial state of Canada and Indigenous peoples has always been one that has been violent. And whether or not there's a way to move forward without justice, without land, and without sort of these really fundamental things that help Indigenous communities be strong and be resilient. And at the same time, there has been a lot of increased attention to Indigenous issues as a result of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in part. So there has been an increased action by the Canadian government to address the inequities between Indigenous communities and Canadians, and trying to address, you know, things like housing, access to clean water, education, although it's moving very slowly in that direction, I would say. And many Indigenous folks are disappointed at how little movement has actually. There's a lot of talk, but not as much action as there needs to be.
Okay. Well, and on that note, we are going to go into our first break, and we will be back here in a moment.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code HEVO, H-E-V-O. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
All right. Okay. Well, I, for one, could definitely talk about this for a very long time. But I do want to go back, since we're still at 15-year-old you, and figure out how you got from 15-year-old you who made a promise to herself that she was going to get a doctorate in archaeology to current you with a doctorate in archaeology. So what was the next step once you made that decision?
Yeah, so once I had put my mind to doing a doctorate, which I sometimes look back on with a fair bit of surprise because neither of my parents finished university. So it's not like I even knew anybody who had a doctorate growing up, but I had, you know, I'm a pretty determined person. And when I make my mind up, things tend to happen. So I went into university. I started my undergraduate degree at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And I enrolled with the intention of doing an anthropology major, but I was also interested in focusing on sort of Near Eastern archaeology as a focus. And so in my first year, I took Latin and I took classics and I took, you know, intro to archaeology and I did a bunch of different things. Huh. And throughout the course of my undergrad, for the first 3 years, certainly, that was still my goal was to go into a graduate program and hopefully do work on, you know, Sumerian cuneiform and ancient civilizations. And I think even that at that point, I was already interested in the spatial side of things, but didn't really know yet how to articulate that. Uh-huh. Took some great courses, but then I took a field school. And I like to talk about my field school as a really important turning point in my career. At the time, I didn't realize how much of a turning point, but reflecting, I know that how important it really was. So I, being, you know, first generation student, not from a wealthy background by any means, and, you know, operating entirely through student loans and whatever I could earn on summers and part-time work, I couldn't afford to take a field school that would have taken me to the areas I really wanted to go at the time. So I ended up enrolling in our local field school, and it was working at a site about an hour and a half east of Vancouver along the Fraser River. And it was a field school that was offered in collaboration with the Scowlitz First Nation. It's part of the Stalo Tribal Council these days. Mm-hmm. And they were a local First Nation. They were the descendants of the peoples whose lands in which we were working. So the history was directly connected to them. And we had community members work on site with us the whole time.
Wow.
At the time, stepping back a minute, sort of how my Indigenous identity intersects with all of this, because of course these two things are deeply interconnected for me. Mm-hmm. My dad was raised in foster care, and so we were disconnected from our Indigenous community. He never even got the opportunity to meet his mother after she was forced to give him up when he was born. So one of the other parts of my journey through university was I was starting to connect in with other Indigenous students, trying to learn more about who we were, where we came from, who our people were. So when I took the field school and was interacting with these two members of the Skalitz First Nation, Clifford Hall and Betty Charlie, they were really supportive of me. And as I would talk to them kind of about my own journey and trying to figure things out, they really took me under their wing and helped to guide me through that whole field school process. And I loved the work. I really enjoyed being in the field, which of course is always a big test when you're trying to figure out whether or not you can actually be an archaeologist. But the best part of that field school was learning from them and learning also what the archaeology meant to them. So being on the sites of their ancestors and their relationship with that place and with that history was really what I connected with. And I learned a lot about, and they, you know, the importance of ceremony. So we had protocol where every day before we went on to the archaeological site, we'd put ochre paste on sensitive parts of our body in order for the ancestors to be able to recognize us as human and as not doing any harm. And that would protect us, and it would also protect them, and it would protect the living community as well. So this deep interconnection was already very present in my field school. But I had this idea in my mind that I was going to go and be this Near Eastern archaeologist. So the next year when I was applying to graduate school, I only applied to one program at one school, and I did not get accepted. And I was a pretty high achieving student. So to me at the time, it felt like the end of the world. Mm-hmm. But it was the best thing that could have happened to me, because mm-hmm. That was not my path. That was not what I was meant to do with this work. So I took a year and did a lot of introspection and thought a lot about what I wanted to do and where I would go from here. And I decided that I wanted to pursue more Indigenous-focused research and work in British Columbia. So I ended up applying to and getting into a master's program at the University of Toronto and worked there with Gary Copeland, who's a Northwest Coast archaeologist, and started my journey into what would lead me to Indigenous archaeology. I did a one-year master's program and then came back to the University of British Columbia with the intention of building a collaborative research project for a PhD, where I would work with some of the Stalo Nation, Stalo Tribal Council bands and do some research on their territory. And that was when I also started to encounter the kind of growing body of literature around Indigenous and collaborative archaeology. So this would have been in like the mid 2004-2005-2006 time period. And engaging with that literature also started to have me thinking more about the nature of collaboration and how do we build collaborative relationships. And so I went in with that strong ethic and intention, and that all kind of blew up in my face. Also, you know, was a difficult process, but a really, really important one in my journey and as a scholar.
We don't have to talk about this, but I'm so if you tell me right now if you don't want to, but I'm very curious about, like, when you're saying about how it blew up, like, is there
Well, I have written about this a bit. So in 2014 I wrote co-authored an article with Gary Warwick. It's published in the Canadian Journal of Archaeology, and it's called Challenges to Community-Oriented Archaeology, and it outlined some elements of my experience that I could share. Basically, what it came down to was I was working in an area where two different nations were making a claim to it in different sorts of ways. Okay. So one of the nations was claiming it through the modern treaty process, because in British Columbia, it's unceded territory. There's never any treaty signed. There was never any agreements or relinquishment of title. So one of the nations was going through the treaty process, and the other one was not, and was purposefully not, because they don't agree with the way in which it's being carried out. But what that meant is I was trying to work in a space that was contested between two First Nations. So when I wanted to come in and do sort of a community-oriented collaborative project, I couldn't only work with one and not the other. Mm-hmm. So I tried to work across both. because I didn't kind of know how else to go about it. And neither of which, of course, were my own community. So that creates its own dynamic. And I tried to do my best to kind of keep everyone satisfied about the research. But in the end, I ended up writing a thesis which focused a lot more on kind of a standard archaeological analysis of the results rather than anything that was deeply engaged with Indigenous ways of knowing and being, because there was an agreement about whose story I would tell. And it was difficult to try to integrate these multiple different perspectives on that land in a way without strongly alienating one or the other. So I was kind of caught in the middle of this. And what it really did for me was had me reflect on the nature of archaeological knowledge, on the ways in which academic research gets taken up in these contemporary discussions about rights and title, and in particularly what it means to do archaeology in an environment which remains deeply colonial and is governed by colonial law and, you know, archaeology's own sort of colonial baggage. So the fact that it all didn't go as planned really forced me to reflect upon what we do as a discipline. And that reflection has really shifted and continues to shift the way in which I practice archaeology now. Because I think a lot about the impacts of the work and who is it impacting in what ways, and what is the possibility of archaeology to do harm to Indigenous communities, even with a collaborative intention, right? So if I had worked with one community and not the other, then I could have caused harm to the community who was not engaged in the research that I was doing. And if I'm centering a particular narrative, which I'm told by a community, are there ways in which that does harm to other communities who are not engaged in the process? So all of this came up out of my doctoral work.
Yeah, that is a real struggle that I know I'm sure a lot of us can relate to.
Yeah, and we're also bound by the nature and structures of our discipline. And that's another thing I've been thinking a lot about, in the ways in which I have to follow the law of the place that I'm in, but the law also restricts the sovereignty of the nations with whom I work. So there's a lot of all these dynamics really play out in our practice.
So is this part of what led you to this concept of heart-centered archaeology, or archaeology of the heart?
Yes, in part. I think there's a number of factors which led me to that. Probably one of the strongest is my dear friend and colleague, Natasha Lyons, who her and I worked together to develop a conference session in the SAAs in 2017 around archaeologies of the heart. I think how this intersects with a lot of these issues I was just describing is that an archaeology of the heart is about the whole person, that we are all whole people. We're not just these intellectual beings, that we have bodies and we have emotions and we have responses and connections in a whole variety of different ways. But archaeology creates a lot of division between mind and heart and spirit. It also creates environments of competition, and it creates environments that are unsafe, which I think we've been at least talking about quite a bit more than we used to. Whether or not we're making them safer, I think that remains to be seen. but I think all of those questions about the nature of how we do archaeology has led to myself and my colleague Natasha and others who have been engaged in this work with me to think about a different way of engaging with one another, engaging with the past, acknowledging the fact that the people whose belongings we study also had emotions and also had hearts and engaged with their own lives in a heart-centered way also. And this very much connects in with a lot of the core ethics and tenets of Indigenous archaeology, but we also see it as something that goes into areas of our practice where the practitioners may not see Indigenous archaeology's connection to them, right? So you imagine someone who's working with Neanderthals in Europe as one example. The indigenous archaeology tends to remain somewhat in the scope of places where there are defined indigenous communities living, their relationship with colonization. And I actually think that's really important that they remain connected to those histories in those places. So archaeology of the heart is one way for us to see this, some of those ethics expand and shifting into a bit of a different way of framing that can translate across all sorts of different archaeological contexts.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, it's really interesting when you're talking about the difference between archaeology of the heart and indigenous archaeology, because when you're talking about, for example, the mind-body disconnect, or, you know, human versus nature, or mm-hmm. all of these things, to me, yeah, in nature, that's a decolonized look at archaeology, because, you know, those are very Western concepts. So mm-hmm. That is interesting. And I'd be curious to hear more about the, like...
Yes, I think that they are both coming from a place of decolonizing our practice. At the same time, when I engage in Indigenous archaeology, it's partly about engaging Indigenous ways of knowing and being. Mm-hmm. So when I'm working on a Métis site, for example, as a Métis woman, I'm engaging and thinking through feeling through being with what it means to do that archaeology from a Métis perspective. Mm-hmm. And again, so one of the areas where I see archaeology of the heart as somewhat separate from Indigenous archaeology is that there's not everywhere is it appropriate to engage a particular grounded Indigenous way of knowing and being. Right. Mm-hmm. Or the practitioner, it might not be appropriate for them to engage it. Right. Because I want to maintain a certain degree of sovereignty over that. Right. And mm-hmm. and that should be shared in particular ways with the learning that comes alongside. So I don't know if someone who's working on the Mongolian steppes should engage a Cree way of knowing and being necessarily. There may be another way for them to engage in their work that is attentive to similar ethics, but that is maybe mm-hmm. more grounded in that place.
Yeah,
right, or grounded
sense.
In a different set of histories. And also mm-hmm. we tend to think of the mind-body division as an inherently Western one, and it is. But if we go deeper into Western history, before that really became well-defined, there are Western traditions that engage in a more holistic way of understanding. So are there some places where that could be interestingly engaged? Mm-hmm. So for me, there's a lot of relationship, but I'm also wary about appropriating elements of Indigenous archaeology to places where they may not necessarily be as appropriate to engage.
Right, right. That totally makes sense.
Yeah. At the same time, so I'm working on this volume. So it's myself, Jane Baxter, Natasha Lyons, and Sonia Adelay. And Sonia, of course, is another well-known Indigenous archaeologist. And her and I think in that book, seek to kind of define some of the differences, but also recognizing that there is some of the literature that grounds in archaeology of the heart is Indigenous studies, Indigenous archaeology, but also feminist approaches, and also heart-centered practice, which comes out of health disciplines in particular, nursing, and some of that, those types of care work. Mm-hmm. So we're mm-hmm. trying to bring these different bodies of theory and of practice to bear on this concept of an archaeology of the heart.
And you said this book comes out in 2020, was it?
Yes, it's coming out with Springer Press in 2020. So look for more information about that. We're hoping to have a book launch, if all goes well, at the upcoming SAAs, which is perhaps a bit ironic.
Yeah.
But that's another conversation.
That is another conversation. you'll have to send us the link once it goes live, and we'll share it with everybody who's mm-hmm. a listener.
I'm really excited about it. And we have quite a diverse group of people who have engaged from all different parts of the world and, different backgrounds. It's going to be really good.
Yeah. Okay. So again, we're already almost at the second stopping point. Okay, so before we get too far from this, you were talking about being a Métis woman, and I would like you to talk a little bit about what that means, because I feel like there are a lot of stereotypes or, you know, people really simplify that identity. I mean, again, I remember growing up and basically what I heard about Métis people was that they're a mixture of Indigenous and French. Mm-hmm. And as an adult who works in this field, I am sure that that is probably not the how you would want your identity presented to yourself. So I would love to hear more about what you think of all of that.
Sure. Thank you for asking that question. It's a very important one. And I will try not to spend another hour talking just about that. So there is a general misconception that to be Métis means having some Indigenous heritage and some generally non-Indigenous heritage, French, but could be other things. And there's been a lot of work by Métis scholars in particular over the last, well, certainly in the last 25 years or so, to unpack and push back against the idea that to be Métis is merely to be mixed. The Métis are, we're a people and we are a nation. And we did emerge really out of the dynamics of the fur trade and engagement between fur traders from France, but also from Scotland and the UK more broadly, and their sort of practice of taking country wives from the Indigenous communities where they were stationed and having children with those Indigenous women, First Nations women. What's interesting in the case of the Métis is that the children of those unions, and we're talking, you know, in the 1600s and 1700s, the children of those unions tended to marry children of similar unions. So there was a lot of building of these kinship networks between the children of these fur traders and these First Nations women. And then they started to form communities where they would live together and these sort of kin connections would grow. And then out of this, you have distinct cultural practices, distinct ways of life. There's a language called Michif. There are symbols. There's forms of dance. And all of these things together, you know, create, you know, a cultural identity. And then in the 1800s, you get the Métis Nation declaring itself a nation and raising a flag, and then at one point going to rebelling against Canada, right? So they see this other nation forming, and the Métis Nation, led by primarily Louis Riel, stood up and said, you must recognize us as a nation, and you must engage with us as a nation, and we will come to an agreement of how we're going to share these lands. And that was one rebellion, which happened in 1869. Then there was a seeming resolution of that, which was the creation of the province of Manitoba through the Manitoba Act, which had these agreements about how the Métis were to be treated. Canada did not uphold those agreements, and then therefore the Métis organized again and rebelled against Canada a second time in 1885, were defeated by Canada, and then our main leader, Louis Riel, was hung as a traitor. So we were a nation at the time. We were trying to assert our sovereignty as a nation against the nation of Canada. And the Métis... Today, we have the Métis National Council and then a series of Métis nations, primarily in the Western Canadian provinces, because it reflects that historical connection to those events, to those kinship communities, right? So there's deep interconnections between Métis sort of across the prairies and into the Northwest Territories. So people who are members of the Métis Nation today are connected into those historical communities, are part of those communities today, and are deeply embedded in these large kinscapes, as we call them. And some of my research actually looks at the interconnectedness of land, of kin, of community, and of the actual material record of that as well.
Right, which you talk about some on the Cultural Landscapes episode.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're at our second break, but we have a lot more to talk about when we come back. So we will be right back.
Hello, it's Jim Eagle. Please join us for the Bay Area American Indian Two-Spirit Society's 11th annual Two-Spirit Powwow in person or online this year at San Francisco Fort Mason Center on Saturday, February 12th, 2022. Gore dance at noon and grand entry begins at 1 p.m. There will be over 60 vendors selling all types of indigenous products and crafts. Powwow dancers from all over the U.S. will be competing in contests all day long. We'll also be having several delicious fried bread taco vendors. For more information, go to baits.org. That's BAAITS.org. COVID protocols will be in effect. See you there.
I want to rewind again for a second. You were talking about your PhD and how things went a little sideways. Mm-hmm. There were some challenges and that you learned a lot from them. So we talked about the collaborative aspect of the of your PhD. What was the actual specific topic of your PhD?
So one of the things that happened when I was in my PhD was I fell in love with spatial analysis and spatial archaeology. I think I probably could have predicted that as I look back. The thing that excited me the most about my field school data that when I got a chance to process it was the stratigraphy, which is probably the first indication that my mind thought in spatial sorts of ways. Because not everyone gets excited about stratigraphy, but man, profiles, those are my jam. I loved working with them. And then when I was in my PhD, I had the opportunity to work with a woman named Sue Formosa, who is a trained surveyor, so had taken a surveying course, but who worked with archaeologists to help map and record archaeological sites. So she put me behind a total station and it instantly made sense to me. It was like, where have you been all my life? I want to do this thing. So for my PhD then, the methodological piece was really about sort of two pieces. One was a spatial analysis piece. And then the other one is that I had developed an interest in conflict and warfare, and the ways in which communities position themselves on landscapes for defensiveness and for protection. So I brought those two things together. And one of the reasons that I was drawn to this area where there was conflict between these two nations was because this area was home to a series of rock formations. So constructed rock formations. So there's terraces and walls that where there was deliberate stacking of different types of rock for different sorts of purposes. And I was very intrigued by this pattern because there was less of that type of construction seen in other parts of the Northwest Coast cultural area where most of the construction happens with shell and wood. And here you have these rock features. And one of the hypotheses around these was that they were defensive sites. So they were specifically designed to protect against raids coming from the coast up the river, and that they had been positioned in these locations to monitor and to defend this part of the river, which is it's a canyon. So it goes from being a wider river to a very constricted space. So my analysis then was of these different sites. I went out and I mapped them. And then I did some analysis in GIS software to look at questions around visibility. So what could you see if you were standing on these features? Could you see them from the river? Like, so what is their role in terms of how visible are they? Are they interconnected in a visual line of sight? So my analysis, therefore, was to try to assess whether or not these were primarily defensive in nature, and my conclusions were not exclusively. So there are definitely some that seem to have a defensive purpose, but then there's other ones that are tucked away. You can't see them from the river. They're not close to any pathways up from the river, and they seem to be creating platforms in order to build large plank houses on, which is the type of housing you see on the coast. And some of them seem to be related to fishing practice as well. And this is a really important fishery area, which is partly, again, why it's contested, because it's easy to catch fish because the river constricts. So you have the same amount of fish, but a lot less space. and therefore they're really easy to catch. And the nature of the canyon also means they're easy to wind dry as opposed to smoke. So, and wind dried salmon in this case lasts longer than smoked salmon. So it was a really, really important area. So all these things sort of together were the focus of my analysis. And then I was also interested in their symbolic role in a place where, you know, most of the building is done with wood and shell. What is the role of building in stone? And what kind of symbolic messaging can that say around how people belong to place and the kind of endurance of that connection to place over time?
I love listening to you talk and hearing, it's so funny listening to you from a Southwest. I'm not an archaeologist, but I work with a lot of archaeologists and tribes and, you know, as an ethnographer. So, because here everything is stone, yep. Like the thought of a shell structure just blows my mind. But that's the stone part is the exotic to up there. But then also here, a lot of people, a lot of tribes really are very sensitive about the study of warfare, mm-hmm. because it has been used in ways that are basically to show things like, oh, the tribes here were cannibals, yep. or that they were very violent, or to put very like negative connotations on people's ancestors. Mm-hmm. And then there was a third thing. So it was the stone and then the warfare. And then, oh, fish. Mm. I mean, I worked at Grand Canyon, and when they asked me to do an analysis for their fish management plan of tribes and cultural connections to fish for the Grand Canyon, and the Pueblo of Zuni has very strong cultural connections to fish and especially related to the Grand Canyon. But for the most part, and I mean, I'm not going to say conclusively nobody, because there are some instances, and especially more historically, nobody ate the fish.
Mm. Yeah.
Like fish was not, in fact, it was very like a look down on, you know, starvation. You really would have to have a reason to eat a fish. Mm-hmm. So it's funny.
Yeah. And I still actually actively work on the Northwest Coast. So I'm part of a collaborative project run by Dr. Andrew Martindale out of UBC, where we work with Tsimshian communities near Prince Rupert on the toward the northern coast of BC, just below Alaska. But I mean, I think that the concepts of the shell, until you've seen a site that's basically made out of shell. So they wouldn't have made the buildings, but they would have used the shell to kind of terraform the land to make it stable and well-drained and create these large shell-bearing sites that are deliberately engineered to be able to then build very large wooden buildings on. And to be honest, if you're living in the rainy Northwest Coast, you wouldn't want to live in a stone building. You'd want to live in a cedar building for a variety of reasons. And but yeah, the different areas definitely have different understandings of what is what you make buildings out of, what you eat, right? So on the prairies, I know Blackfoot folks don't eat fish, but the Métis, we ate lots of fish. If it was around, we'd eat it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always it's just interesting, and also again highlighting the importance of being collaborative and talking to yep. your local community, because even if they're in the same area, they may have different perspectives on the same thing, and especially if they're in different areas. Yep.
And of course, as archaeologists, when we're trying to put together a sense of an ancient way of life, there is a tendency, if we're not a member of those communities, to make interpretations that actually don't at all connect with the cultural understanding of those things and those places. And sometimes all you need to do is go talk to someone. They're like, nope, nope, that's not ritual. That was a lice comb, right? Or mm-hmm. something similar, yeah. right? Something very mundane, right? So yeah. it's interesting to have those conversations sometimes.
Yes, yes, definitely had those experiences, mm-hmm. both directions.
Yes, right.
Yeah, okay, so what about after you got your PhD? So you're moving on from this study, you learned a lot and taught you a lot about ethics and how you want to approach research. Where did you go from there?
So the story actually sort of overlaps here. So I actually got hired in a tenure track position at the University of Alberta the year before I finished my PhD. So I was just finishing up and I was exploring postdoc options, as one does, because I was sort of loosely on the job market, but there weren't really any positions to apply for. So it was all about postdocs and other sort of temporary positions. So I had applied to the University of Alberta to do a postdoc under there is a postdoc program here that has its own funding. And the department chair here saw my CV and saw something in it because she really wanted to try to get me here in a permanent position. At the time, the provost of the university had a program where you could get a position that targeted an Indigenous hire. It was actually called Aboriginal at that time. We don't really use that term as much in Canada anymore, but at the time that's what it was called. And so she was able to wrangle a position that I entered into just under a year before I finished and defended my PhD, which was a shock, I can tell you very much. It was like, I had applied for a postdoc. I had chatted with someone who is a faculty member here, and he's like, well, these are very competitive. We're not sure what's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And then like 2 weeks later, I get we'd like to interview you for a tenure track job. I was like, what? Come again? Did you send this to the right person? It was just really surprising. And it's, you know, in Canada now, 9 years later, there's more of this happening, which I think is good in a variety of ways. But at the time, it wasn't as much of a thing. And so it was very, very surprising to me. At the same time, ironically, I had always said throughout my entire career that I wanted a tenure track job by the time I was 30. I started my job here, I was 29. Whoa. So apparently if you say it, it will happen sometimes.
Yeah. Doing like the, what was that book called?
Right?
The Secret or whatever.
Which I've never even read, but
like,
apparently.
Say it and it'll come to you.
If you build it, they will come.
Yeah, right? Me either, but.
Yes. But again, it was one of those things that was really, really important that it happened, because this is actually my homeland. My father was born in Edmonton. My extended Métis family has very deep connections. So my four times great-grandparents got married at one of the first versions of Fort Edmonton, which was part of the fur trading companies that eventually became the city. So coming home was a really important thing for me to do. It set me onto a path where I started working with my own relatives, with my own histories. And it also allowed me to meet a lot of my living relatives. Because one of the challenges we face for those of us who are disconnected is sort of, where do we fit in to these communities? And what is our role, right? So standing up and saying I'm a Métis woman, I say that with a different relationship to what that means than I would have when I first got here, because I know more what it means, and I know who claims me as part of their family and their community. So these two things, both on a personal level, but then the professional development of a Métis archaeology, were both very important for me to have done in this place. So about a year after coming here, I'd finished up my dissertation. Things had not, wasn't super happy about how it had all gone. Still kind of grappling with all of what that meant for me. And I had one of those, you know, those classic aha moments that they talk about, where I was in a talk here on the U of A campus, and I was listening to someone talk about Métis history. And I went, I wonder if anyone's doing Métis archaeology or talking about the Métis archaeological record. And turns out there had been a couple of things done in the 80s, and that was pretty much it in terms of a scholarship. Wow. on Métis sites. And this is particularly important because the Métis homeland really is the central sort of central western part of Canada. It's a huge area that we consider to be the homeland. Of course, we also acknowledge that the Métis homeland is First Nations territories, so there's interesting dynamics around some of that. But at the same time, we have an archaeological record that stretches over a huge area. And when development happens, the Métis are almost never consulted about the archaeology. So I shudder to think how much archaeological impacts have happened without engagement with the Métis Nation, because there has a tendency to say, okay, pre-contact stuff, you know, we'll consult. And then the historic stuff is a whole nother category, and it tends to be lumped in with sort of European. But we are a post-contact indigenous people. So our archaeological record is a post-contact record. It's a historical archaeology record.
Right.
And so as I started to explore the scholarship that had been done, I realized there was a lot that needed to happen. And there was a lot that could be done to really demonstrate where the Métis were and how that connects to our rights. Because we have what are known as Aboriginal rights under the Canadian Constitution. But there's been a tendency to kind of limit Métis to very specific places, when in fact we were highly mobile and we had this broad range of a homeland. So my work since that since that time when I had that aha moment has really been to start up a program of Métis archaeology, and then also to refocus the ways in which the Métis are talked about in the archaeological record, because all the earlier stuff was all about mixedness. So it was all about hybrid sort of things, or the Métis tried to be more or less European. And my research is really about understanding Métis archaeology from a Métis perspective, not from a mixedness perspective, not from, you know, trying to be more European or more First Nations, but people who just were being Métis. And what does that look like in the archaeological record? So I spent the last 5 years working on a large research project that really has that at its goal, establishing what that looks like, because then it allows us to apply that across the homeland, right? So
is that where the Institute of Prairie Archaeology comes in?
Yes, in part. So the work that I've been doing with my own heritage and my own history and my own family has really started to sort of have me think through what it means to practice Indigenous archaeology with my own heritage. Because it's different for me doing Indigenous archaeology with a community that's not my own, even as an Indigenous person. It's a little bit different for me than doing it on my own history and my own heritage. And this has come to help me think through where we kind of need to go from here, where I see we need to go from here. So the Institute of Prairie Archaeology is going to be expanding its scope as I take on the directorship this year, to become the Institute of Prairie and Indigenous Archaeology. And it really is designed to do three things. One is to continue doing Indigenous engaged research and increasingly community driven research, research questions defined by community. We bring in the expertise to address them. It's a pedagogical piece, so it's about teaching. I taught an Indigenous archaeology course last term for the first time, and I loved it. Love teaching it, because I started off by asking the students, what gives non-Indigenous people the right to study Indigenous pasts, right? That's an extremely powerful question for them, because they'd never been asked it before.
Yeah. I'm sure you must have knocked a couple of them off their seat.
I did, and that was great. And they all rose to the occasion. They got knocked down, and then they built themselves back up, and then had another existential crisis a few weeks later, and got through all of that.
Yeah.
But it was transformative for a number of them. And so I want to continue teaching in ways that center, you know, Indigenous ways of knowing and being, and how that intersects with archaeology. And then the third piece is around policy and practice. Unlike in the United States, in Canada, there's a lot of unevenness in the ways in which First Nations and Métis and Inuit groups engage with archaeology, because we don't have NAGPRA, we don't have TIPOs. So there's some nations are very active in that engagement, and others are less so. And I want to see every nation in Canada have a cultural heritage policy that they can hand over to a developer and say, you're going to work on our territory, this is what you need to do. That's a very long-term goal, but I want the Institute to be able to start to incubate some of that work to bring in nations who want to do or are interested in developing those, connecting them with nations who have done some of that work, building best practices, building capacity in communities, because most archaeology happens outside of a research context. It happens in development contexts. So I want to see our practice change in those areas as well.
Hmm. Sounds like an interesting podcast episode.
Indeed. I think so.
Indeed.
Well, and then there's the whole question of the law, but that's another hurdle to try to think through at some point as well. So the Institute will do a lot of this work, I'm hoping.
Mm. Wow. Okay. So we are already almost at the end, which is crazy. But where would you like to go next? So we've talked about the Institute. Obviously, that's going to be really important work that you're doing. Do you have any other topics that you're really inspired to be pursuing right now or into the future?
I think for me, my focus is really, I mean, the research, I'm going to continue building this Métis research. I'm writing a book which really centers a Métis way of knowing and being and how it applies to the archaeological record. So a total framework for how we might do that. I'm really excited about that. But really where my energy is being drawn is in these questions around capacity building, around kind of changing practice more broadly, right? Beyond my own sphere. You know, because honestly, Métis archaeology is a very limited sphere and it connects to Indigenous archaeology, which of course is very important. But I want to see shifts in practice beyond that. And so I think a lot of my attention is going to start to shift toward the teaching side. So teaching archaeologists differently, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous archaeologists, recruiting and mentoring Indigenous archaeologists, because as someone who does work on my own heritage, it's very different for me. And I now have two Métis students who are working with me. And we can have conversations that I just can't have with my non-Métis students because we're coming at it from a similar worldview. So that's really important. And I just want to support the sovereignty of Indigenous nations around their own cultural heritage. So, you know, the laws of the lands currently known as Canada say that the materials of the past belong, in our case, to the provinces or territories, not necessarily to the nations whose past they are. And for me, this is a really important shift in the way that we think. You know, who should have control over the objects of the history, right? So we archaeologists are stewards of the past, but nations, it's the belongings of their ancestors. Right. So I want to support nations in, you know, claiming their right to manage, to make decisions about the belongings of their own ancestors. And I want to be able to make decisions about the belongings of my own ancestors as well. I don't necessarily want them to have to end up in a box, in a warehouse, in a museum. They're not doing the work that they need to do in our communities if they're tucked away like that. So coming to ways where we can work with institutions and work with governments to find ways to support that sovereignty is really important to me.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we close out here? I mean, again, I could ask you 50 million more questions.
I'll just have to come back.
More things.
I'll just have to come back and talk about more things. I really appreciate having the opportunity to talk about a number of these things. And I encourage people who are listening who might be interested in some of the work that I'm doing to reach out. One of the goals of the Institute is to build stronger networks, especially because in the United States, there's sort of mechanisms for doing that somewhat. And in Canada, there's less of that. So it's important for me to be a part of a community of practice. And so I certainly encourage people to look me up and you know, make contact through that. And if you're interested in one particular part of the work, I'm going to be hosting workshops and doing other activities through the Institute that hopefully you'll be able to be involved with.
So when you say there's less mechanisms for that, what are you referring to?
Well, I think there's fewer of us, archaeologists and also Indigenous archaeologists. I'm trying to get a sense of how many, but also because the nature of the law in Canada is that practice is very provincial or territorial. So it's very much bounded by, like it would be in the state in the US. Mm-hmm. There's nothing federally. There's no umbrella federally for any of the heritage work. So I think about like the systems of TIPOs where you can reach out to other TIPOs. You kind of know where there's a point of contact. We don't really have anything equivalent to that here. So I think I'd like to build more of that network and connect into the one in the US a little bit more because having conversations with other Indigenous archaeologists is really important as well.
Yeah. And on that note, forgive my ignorance here, but there are Métis people in the US, right?
There are. There sure are. They're not recognized in the way they are in Canada. Like in Canada, we're one of the three recognized Aboriginal peoples under the Constitution. But there are Métis communities in Montana, in the Dakotas especially. And then, of course, there's Métis folks in the diaspora as well.
Okay. And is there, has there been work between the U.S. and Canadian Métis communities?
There has been some, and I'm hoping to increase that as we move forward with this work, because the 49th parallel, the border, is very arbitrary and very much divided our communities. There's a great book called Métis and the Medicine Line, it's called, and it's really about the ways in which that really divided divided First Nations communities as well, but it very much divided the Métis communities who were used to being, you know, very interconnected across this wide, wide area. So in the future, I'm hoping to do more work. It's difficult, though. It's difficult to work across jurisdictions. So, again, those colonial boundaries and ways of dividing us still are entrenched in our practice today.
Right. And as somebody who grew up on the other U.S. border,
yep,
it's very much the same for Indigenous communities down there.
Exactly, right? And I'm sure it's only getting more difficult.
Yes, it is definitely tricky. There's a fabulous video, actually, come to think of it, put on by the Tonawatam Nation, which is the one of the main communities that was cut, not in half because it wasn't really half, but by the border, and is just getting really the brunt of the border situation. You know, they're having to put a lot of their own money into protection, and you know, the border patrol will just come through and cut their fences all the time, just all kinds of consequences, things like not being able to prove which side of the border they were born on, and not being able to get veteran benefits because of things like that. It's a mess. But they have a fabulous video, and let me make a note to myself to include that in the show notes.
I look forward to it.
All right. Well, it was fabulous talking to you. Thank you again for coming on our show again, and hopefully we'll do it again in the future.
Yes, absolutely. I really had a great time, and I look forward to continuing the conversation in the future.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.